Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This week on the Gary Hour.
One of the things I actually remember very clearly was our paperwork said Jew. If you were a Jew in Russia, you were not a Russian. The people's paperwork said Russian and our paperwork said Jew. And there was a limit in how many Jews could go to universities.
Right now, simultaneously in this country, President Trump is interrupting all the networks, going on live TV, saying that the border wall is a national emergency.
Yes.
And all these refugees need to be stopped.
Yeah.
Now you, as you know, first generation refugee.
Zero generation.
Right. If you have a child, that they will be first generation.
Correct.
So you yourself are a refugee.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how do you feel about the southern border and how he's saying that they should be stopped? Welcome to another episode of The Gary Hour. I am your host, Gary Levitt. This week, I talk to comedian and comedic writer, among other things, Boris Hykin. He emigrated here from Ukraine when he was 7 years old. We're going to hear all about life in Ukraine and coming here. He's not a first generation. He is the generation. This episode is brought to you by Future Moments, makers of mobile apps for content creation. If you're a musician, a podcaster, voiceover artist, filmmaker, or someone that just makes videos on their phone and you want to improve them, go to the App Store and search for Future Moments because they have an app that'll make your life easier and your productions so much better. Thanks for listening. Check out the show notes for links to Boris and more. Yes. Okay. Boris Hykin. Cut. Boris Hykin.
Yeah, no, leave it in. Yeah. I want people to see that this is part of my life's difficulties, you know?
Yeah, because your name is spelt Kaken phonetically. Or Kaken.
Or Kaken. I had a lot of teachers do like Boris Kaken and then stop themselves after they already said the bad part.
Yeah.
And then try to confirm. And I'm like, well, it's too late now, but it's
get Hykin. People in trouble. Your IMDb list is extensive. You're actor, writer, director. You have so much stuff on IMDb.
I know. I don't know how that happened. They started, a bunch of stuff just got listed all of a sudden.
You're prolific.
I guess so.
Yeah.
I didn't realize it myself. One time I just happened upon my IMDb and I was like, oh, wow, I'm prolific.
Is that what you do if you get down? You just open your IMDb and scroll?
Just to jerk off to my own IMDb page.
Look, Mom.
And show my mother at the same time.
Yes. All right. So where are you from? You have a very interesting look.
Well,
a very un-American look.
Oh man, what an othering, a microaggression to start with. No, I got a big beard. I didn't used to. I've only had this beard for like a year and a half.
Yeah,
I think when we met, I might have not even had the beard.
Yeah, you didn't have the beard.
But I am originally from Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
I came here in '91 and moved to Central Jersey, Edison, New Jersey, and I was in Jersey until 2007, because I went to college at Rutgers, also in Jersey, and then I've been in Brooklyn, New York, Manhattan, Hoboken for a year.
How old were you when you came here from the Ukraine?
I turned 7, like right after we came here.
Okay, so you were just like 6, 7 years old, and you're like, I'm done with this place.
Yeah, well, my parents were done with the place. I made few decisions on my own behalf.
I would imagine so.
Yeah.
Well, what were your parents doing in the Ukraine, that, and why did they leave?
Well, that's a long story. My parents were both engineers in Ukraine.
Engineers, what do you mean?
My mom was an electrical engineer. She did like microcircuit design. And my dad was, I'm going to say like audio video, actually. Really, he worked at a TV studio in Ukraine and did a lot of like various camera stuff and audio stuff.
Cool. Why did they leave?
Well, the Berlin Wall fell, and so they were able to leave. But in general, there was not a good economy in the Soviet Union. There was a big underground economy.
What do you mean underground economy?
Well, meaning like it was communism, so everybody had their job. Technically, you worked for the state, no matter what your job was. But it was kind of like everybody pretended to work, and the state kind of pretended to pay you and provide stuff. So like everybody got very low wages.
Mm.
Everybody kind of half-assed their work because it didn't matter. They couldn't be fired. It did nothing really, you know.
Right. If you worked hard, you still got paid the same as if you worked little.
Basically just, you know, shorthand communism. But in addition to that, if people did have ambition, they would find work underground. So my dad, for instance, worked fixing VCRs, and the people that had VCRs were very wealthy in the first place. Mm-hmm. And even if you had a VCR, if your VCR broke, you weren't necessarily, or almost, you know, definitely you weren't going to just buy a new VCR, you were going to get it fixed. So he would go from, you know, person to person and fix VCRs. And funny enough, he met my mom because I think she, either my grandma, I'm not clear on this story entirely, and also apparently it might have been a setup, but like he met my mom fixing either like her, one of her relatives' VCRs, but I've asked about this and it sounded like somebody tried, like kind of set it up that way.
Yeah. So you would think with communism that, I mean, in an ideal communist society, everyone's paid a decent wage.
Well, in an ideal any society, everyone's paid a decent wage.
True, but right.
But in reality, it's according to his needs, right? As Marx said it, to each according to their need. And unfortunately...
Well, who decides the needs?
Well, exactly. So, you know, the people that became oligarchs that worked for the government initially decided their needs were a little bit bigger than other people's needs. And then...
Well, they didn't have a VCR, so they had no need for...
For my dad to come and fix it. Yeah. But, I mean, that was one of the issues. Also, you know, even one of the things I actually remember very clearly was our paperwork... said Jew. If you were a Jew in Russia, you were not a Russian. The people's paperwork said Russian and our paperwork said Jew. And there was a limit in how many Jews could go to universities. And if you were practicing, my grandma actually told me recently, because most of my family is not religious because that was also not allowed. So most people did not practice religion. Some practiced it in secret, but they were actually taking a risk. Like my grandma was telling me not long ago that like she would drop her mother off at the synagogue and her mother would be like, don't come near it with me, because she would risk, she was a doctor in the Ukraine, and she would risk her ability to go to medical school if somebody ratted and found out that she was practicing Judaism.
She was a secret Jew.
My grandma wasn't a Jew at all, but her mother was a Jew, and she, I guess, at that point was old enough where it didn't really matter for whatever was going on in her life. But most people were either not practicing or were doing it in secret. Although I do know that there were a few churches that had deals with the government where, like, if they properly revered the government, that they were allowed to practice in some way.
What Catholic churches?
Orthodox, I believe, yeah.
Orthodox Jewish churches?
No.
Yeah, no
absolutely
such thing.
Absolutely not.
So, forgive my ignorance, but what was the Ukraine doing during World War II? What was happening there?
Well, there was, let's see, there was, I'm not going to give you a too clear history lesson, but I know my grandma's brother died fighting in World War II. Ukraine was part of USSR, so I don't know if I'd be able to speak explicitly or specifically about the Ukraine, but the Soviet Union was at war with the Nazis. Technically, the Soviet Union, you know, sort of won the war. Mm. The U.S. is what kind of brought about a change, like an actual peace and an influx, and oversaw establishment of infrastructure and things like that. But the Soviet Union, to their detriment and benefit, was willing to throw a lot of bodies into fighting the war.
Right.
And they had the, you know, AK-47, which famously is one of the most reliable guns in history still to this day, which during the winter, a lot of the German guns would freeze up in the winter, whereas the AK-47 is one of the most reliable guns because of the way it's designed.
That's a Russian gun?
Avtomat Kalashnikov, yeah.
That's what the AK stands for?
Yeah.
Ah. So even though Russians thought of Jews as not even Russians,
right,
they still were fighting the Nazis. Why?
Well, it was empires. They were fighting in empires, and it wasn't... For starters, when I lived there, you're talking about, you know, a while later after World War II. So yeah. There's a bunch of cultural differences and things like that.
You do not look that old to be alive during World War II.
Right. and the thing is that it's pretty complicated. Even my limited understanding of both the history and the, like, political aspects of it, Jews were also very involved in the communist revolution. The Bolsheviks were Jewish. There were Jews in America that were involved in financing the communist revolution, and there still are a lot in America that feel positively about it, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's pretty complex. There's a lot of nuance. A lot of nuance, a lot of self-sabotage as well.
Mm-hmm. So even though Jews in Russia during that time were considered not Russian, were they considered lower class? Or animals or something like that?
No, I don't know if it was lower class necessarily. I think it was just needed to be controlled.
Mm-hmm.
There's a theme of Jews being scapegoats in various different cultures. And it was sort of, in a lot of ways, it might echo an idea that they were seen as sort of privileged in a way.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Were they low class people or were they wealthy Jews?
I'm sure there were both. Mm-hmm. During the, like, revolution, there were, like, you had Cossack farmers, and I'm sure some of which were Jews, that were considered, you know, it was basically the communist leaders would pit the very poor against the slightly less, more productive poor, and so that's how you end up getting everybody on board to overthrow stuff and take over the farmlands, and then you can't run the farmlands efficiently, and then you get famine.
Mm-hmm.
That's the communist revolution in a very small nutshell.
Right, like a four frame cartoon.
Yeah, very pixelated.
Nice. So your parents came here from the Ukraine. How did they get here? How did they get, did they come here legally? Did they get citizenship? Was it arranged?
Came here legally. It was basically chain migration is what you would call it. So when the wall fell in 89, I knew my parents wanted to get out of there, kept it very quiet, didn't tell me until we were definitely leaving. Didn't tell their parents because my mother's father, until very late, was a proud communist. And a lot of people over there that didn't, like my dad and certain other people, would listen to Voice of America and they would get information from outside. But if you didn't get information from outside, it's people really underestimate how easy it is to be brainwashed. And so, while a lot of the populace was miserable, you might not necessarily know that there's an alternative to that misery, or you wouldn't be able to express that misery out loud because you would be a traitor to your country.
Right.
So my grandpa, I know they didn't tell until we were like just ready to leave. And we couldn't get in at first. They filed paperwork. There was I remember my dad mentioning Frank Lautenberg had some sort of arrangement where he changed the immigration policy where we were already ready to leave and we got kind of screwed because when you announce you're leaving, you're a traitor to the state.
Right.
And so you automatically now can't work legally. You can't do any of that stuff. So I don't know all the intricacies of it.
But you're not arrested. You're just considered a traitor.
You're not arrested. And I don't know, again, I don't know enough details on it. But I know at one point they were trying to go to Israel because we couldn't go to America. But they wanted to go to America. There was no opening or whatnot. Then what happened was my mom became pregnant with my younger brother. And because my grandma was a doctor there and it would be immigrating to a new country, she wanted to stay and have my brother there. And so during the time that we stayed and she had my brother, a spot opened up for us to come to America. So we came to America as refugees, thanks to my father's mother's, no, my father's, my step, my, his mom, my dad's dad died a year before I was born. Also funny story, from drinking horse milk in Uzbekistan.
Uh-huh. That sounds very Borat.
Yeah, it is. It is very Borat. But he was stationed there during the war, I think World War II, but I'm honestly
are,
not.
Are you supposed to drink horse milk?
They no, yeah, exactly. So he didn't just fucking suckle on the teat and non-consensually, although the horse, I'm sure, gave no consent one way or another. But yeah. But no, they drank horse milk, and it was not pasteurized, and there was a bacteria that he got, and it took like 20 years to take him out. Basically, like, paralyzed him. He spent the last like 5 years or so
of his life
in the hospital. Yeah, it was like a slow death. But his, my grandmother remarried, and her new husband, the family was, I don't know how they moved to America, but they came to America. So thanks to them, they, my grandparents were able to come, and then thanks to us, we came.
Now, how do you do that? You get refugee status. So do they have to know somebody here in the United States?
That's
too?
Part of it. So I know they changed U.S. immigration laws twice, were major changes, once in 65 and once in 82.
And they're refugees. They're not running from a war. They're just running from a system.
Persecution, and also at the time, well, the Berlin Wall fell, so it wouldn't necessarily be communist refugees, although I think the fact that there was still such a chaotic system where they were figuring out Ukraine as an independent nation,
right,
and the structure collapsing, and just in general, it was a very unstable economy, and add to that the fact that we were Jews. A lot of Jews came from former Soviet countries between, like, I'm going to say even 87, but definitely mostly after the wall fell, because that's when they were really able to leave. From like 89 to like 93, I think there was probably a very large influx of Russian Jews.
And we're doing this podcast right now, simultaneously in this country. President Trump is interrupting all the networks, going on live TV, saying that the border wall is a national emergency.
Yes.
And all these refugees need to be stopped.
Yeah.
Now, you, as, you know, first generation refugee.
Zero generation.
Right. If you have a child, that they will be first generation.
Correct.
So you yourself are a refugee.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how do you feel about the southern border and how he's saying that there should be stopped?
I don't think it's an emergency, that's for sure. And I don't think that, because he's trying to call it a national emergency to get funding for building the wall.
Right. A little loophole.
Yeah. I don't think it's a real loophole. I don't think he's going to be able to do that. I don't think it'd be a good idea if you were able to do it. But in general, I don't think that's a legal thing.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel any kinship with the people trying to get in from Honduras, Nicaragua, all these places that are Venezuela?
It depends. I mean, I feel kinship with anybody trying to immigrate anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a pretty complicated issue. I think that it's a shame that it's Trump who's the one addressing it.
Yeah.
I think the U.S. does have immigration issues. I think that for a long time, Republicans and Democrats did a very bad job of addressing any of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's good that everybody's talking about it, but it's a shame that it's Donald Trump that's
right,
making everybody talk about it, because it kind of makes the whole conversation nonsense.
When you hear stories about the Ukraine and populism in general, do you see similarities with some of Trump's words? Like enemy of the people, the press, and...
I can't say I have enough knowledge about the rise of populism in the Ukraine. Ukraine now, especially, there's Russian populist movements.
Mm-hmm.
So, because, you know, Russia invaded
Ukraine.
Crimea. And even over there, it's like pretty complicated. There's a lot of Russian nationalists who live in Ukraine. I speak Russian, not Ukrainian.
Uh-huh.
In a lot of villages, people spoke Ukrainian.
Now, you speak Russian because you grew up with your parents who kept speaking it here?
No, I speak Russian because it was my first language.
Right.
But in general, my parents, I can understand. Ukrainian to me just sounds kind of like somebody speaking Russian with a speech impediment or something. It's like, it's almost like.
Like a Southern accent compared to.
It's like Spanish and Portuguese, but a little bit closer still.
Right, right.
Than Spanish and Portuguese. So I could understand it. I definitely can't speak it. And I probably couldn't understand it some of the time either. But long story short, you know, there's a lot of debt in Ukraine that Russia supposedly can take on, that the European Union can't take on because they can't take on a lot of Greece. So there's a lot of older population in Ukraine that's especially Western, that has some Russian nationalism to it. A lot of the younger population, A, isn't dependent on a lot of those programs, and B, is much more passionate about human rights. And you know, Russia being homophobic and having a lot of other human rights issues. Right. So there, you have a big generational divide there, and you have a big economic divide.
Some Ukrainians want to be part of Russia.
Some do.
And some don't.
Yeah. And again, it's kind of like a complicated history because it used to be part of Russia at one point and then it wasn't part of Russia. And then Ukraine is like not... It's not that people are strong Ukrainian nationalists either, because it's not like Ukraine's taking that great care of people.
Right.
And Ukraine had a crazy thing where Russia was supplying oil to Europe at one point, and they had a pipeline through Ukraine, and Ukraine was just siphoning oil illegally from Russia. Now they've built a new pipeline. But again, it's a lot of nuance to the situation.
Yeah. Yeah, I imagine. So your parents still around?
They live in Jersey.
They live in Jersey. Wow, from Ukraine to Jersey.
Yep.
So they end up getting here. Do they have jobs lined up?
No. So we got help from a Jewish organization to find our first apartment, and I got like hand-me-down clothes and things like that. They, when they first moved here, my dad got a job repairing VCRs and TVs and stuff for some like repair shop. I think it was called like HR audio video.
Continuing the career.
Basically.
But like, where do you move to? You come here from a whole totally different country.
Right.
Where do you end up? Where do you live?
Well, because we already had those relatives that were my grandparents' other children from my grandfather's other marriage.
Okay.
They lived in Jersey. I'm not sure if it was Edison specifically, but somewhere near there.
And they're just like, we'll take in this whole family.
No, they didn't. They didn't. We got an apartment.
Okay.
But it was like a project housing complex that was like Section 8 housing, basically. Mm-hmm. My dad was working at that HR audio video spot. My mom got a job. I think she was working like painting jewelry, some kind of menial, like minimum wage stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And while they did that, so I had my one pair of grandparents that was here. I had my mom's parents. The other pair of grandparents came, I think, say 2 years or 3 years later.
Mm-hmm.
But
they're just bringing the whole family.
Chain migration.
Yeah.
That's how it works. Yeah. So while that happened, my mom would work during the day painting jewelry, she went to school for computer programming.
Wow.
And so
this is while raising children, like you're seven or up at the time.
Yeah. My grandparents helped a lot at that time, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And then once the other grandparents came, that was also a very big help for them.
You just have one younger brother?
One younger brother.
Okay.
So yeah, my mom was going to work during the day, to school at night. And then once she finished, because, you know, there's not a huge future in fixing TVs and VCRs, as you might imagine, based on today's world.
Yeah, they don't fix anything anymore.
They don't fix anything. Also, we don't have VCRs anymore. And also your TV is, you know, it's cheap. It's made in China. And most of the time when it breaks, it's either under warranty or you're going to get a new one.
Yeah, it's cheaper to just throw it out and get a new one than to fix it.
Yeah, I probably. I mean, it's crazy. Do you remember when like plasma screens and shit first came out?
Yeah.
It was like, it was such a measure of wealth. I remember when you were a kid, how big a TV someone had.
Yeah.
And now like you never really know, because there's like really expensive big TVs. But then there's also like $300 big screen TVs that like your friend who like is technically in debt, but has, you know, whatever.
Yeah. I remember when some of these big screen TVs came out and you'd be, the thing it was, the film wasn't even caught up to the television.
You'd see flaws and stuff.
Yeah. You could see, it looked like it was filmed on a cheap camera because the TV was too nice for the.
Well, that was probably big back when they had CRTs still, because when LCD screens, as a dad that fixes this shit, I know a few things, when LCD screens first came out, they weren't as good as the best, like, old, like, cathode ray tube TVs.
Uh-huh.
The resolution wasn't as good. Even to this day, a lot of them, the blacks, because they're, the lights is all throughout the LEDs,
yeah,
the absolute blacks, it's not as much of a contrast because you right. can't have actual black, whereas a CRT TV can have actual black.
Of course.
Of course. That's like we all know. But anyway, I digress. So once my mom finished school and got a job as a computer programmer, my dad started going to school at night so that now she could be home with us at night and my dad would work during the day and go. And then eventually they both became computer programmers. And that's when, like, after a couple of years, they finally were able to, like, make a real living for themselves and,
right.
and
so
get
they,
out of debt.
They worked poor. Pretty hard when they got here.
Yeah, I'd say that's an understatement.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I see that. I live in Queens, you know, and my neighbors and people that run the laundromat, they seem to have come from
China. Yeah, they work their asses off.
Work their asses off, constantly working.
Yeah.
It's kind of amazing. So your parents did that. They worked their asses off. They got made a better life for themselves.
Also, I could move to Brooklyn and be a comedian.
Be a comedian. But you're more than a comedian. You're a writer and an actor.
Yeah. I do a lot of video. It's funny because I started doing, like, sketch and stuff to have more control over my own career, to, like, put myself on camera and get my name out there and
write
stuff.
Write your own stuff.
Yeah. But then I realized, you know, you say actor, but that's probably where I, like, credit myself last, because I think it's the thing I'm the least good at. Like, I feel like I'm okay when it's something that I fit. But what happened was I started writing sketches, and then I'd realize, especially if I want to direct, I'm not going to act in it, because that's a recipe for disaster right. most of the time. Even with, you know, talented celebrities, they'll write and act and then direct their own thing, and it'll come out like garbage.
Yep.
But I would be like...
It's hard to get that objectivity.
For sure. It's just, yeah, it's a very difficult thing to do. But then I would also think of friends that I'm like, oh, this person will be so much funnier in this role than mm-hmm. me. And so I started directing a lot of stuff and... Yeah, I still do a lot of directing and video editing.
Do you see this as a continuation from your father's work? You're like, I'm going to do the same, but I'm going to be in front of the TV
yeah.
or in the TV.
Yeah. Well, I think some of the technical skills, for sure. I mean, when I was a little kid, I was like taking apart radios and stuff. My dad still has a hobby, you know, right now he's actually unemployed, but as a hobby, he would buy old like tube radios and fix them up.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what's funny is at first he did it because he thought he would like, then he like bought an old broken one on eBay and like fixed it up. And then he would always be like, after I fix it, I'll be able to sell it for more. And then he fixed it up and he's like, nah, I'm too, I like it. He just kept it. And now if you go to our house, he's got like five of these little tube, like old, like 1940s to 60s radios.
It's like a museum like in there. Powered.
Yeah, a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And well, now I'll go to like, if I'm traveling somewhere, I'll stop by an antique store and I'll see some like old Zenith radio for $20. And mm-hmm. I'll be like, this looks like it's in okay condition. I bet my dad could fix it.
So do you guys go back to the Ukraine?
We went once.
Mm-hmm.
We were planning on going, actually. My parents and me and my girlfriend, my brother and his girlfriend, we were all going to do a big family trip this next summer. But now there's martial law there, and it's pretty unstable.
In the Ukraine, what do you mean by martial law? What does that mean?
Well, exactly what it sounds like. There's curfews and mm-hmm. there's high like government control right now. They have the army out. I don't know too much more than that because I haven't looked at it that closely. My dad has a friend that lives there, and our hometown, Odessa, which is on the Black Sea, it's a really nice. It's a famous town from there. It's mm-hmm. really beautiful. It's got this boardwalk with all these discotheques and. The opera house is there. It's like the cultural center because that's where the port was. Mm-hmm. So you had a lot of imports there and things like that. And so we were going to go back, but because of martial law, we canceled. We were just beginning to plan it. And they already had issues happening in Western Ukraine and had finally reached Odessa, where we'd heard from relatives that the unemployment rate's really high. It's not super safe in certain areas. And there's curfews and it's just, you know, not a great time to visit.
You would be able to fly in there, but it just wouldn't be any joy.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure we would be able to fly in there. And also, you know, compared to a lot of the populace that lives there, we're wealthy now as almost any American.
Right.
So if you go and you have, when we did go, I'm trying to remember what year it was. I'm going to say like 15 years ago or something. No, not hounded, nothing like that, because there are rich people also that go there. Mm-hmm. In fact, when we went to like the discos and stuff like that, like way, way richer than your average American, like oligarchs, like Russian oligarchs, like old school, that like when communism fell, right, the people that were connected to government just kind of like inherited and took for themselves whatever.
Right.
It wasn't a smooth transition to the free market.
Yeah.
So there in these discotheques would be tons of like mafia looking dudes and these oligarchs and stuff. But when we visited, it was still just like the culture of corruption is also still very much there, which to this day, like, I am hesitant to do any kind of business with Russian people.
Really?
Oh, for sure. It's just in the culture that like the
dishonesty,
scheming. Yeah, for sure. Just like short term, and not everybody, there's still decent human beings.
Yeah, of course.
But there's just this mode of operation where the not decent human beings are like really permanently fixed in this way, where like, there's, even when it's not good for them, there's insurance scams that Russians pull in America. Mm-hmm. Like, just a lot of businesses where I would just, like, if I'm getting a contractor, I probably, even though I have an uncle that's a contractor, he's a very nice, honest man. But if I didn't know them and I was working and trying to get a contractor, I would not work with a Russian dude.
Right. Do you see a difference from a Ukrainian person and a Russian person?
I don't think I know it well enough.
Okay.
Yeah. Cause especially because I have a decent, like almost coincidentally, I have friends that ended up being Russian from Belarus, from Kazakhstan, from like mm-hmm. other cities, you know, Kiev and Moscow. And I just know the things that are in common, because the things that are different are just as different as the things that are different between anybody else or me and any American. You know?
Sure. Absolutely. What's the perspective on Putin?
Also mixed. I can't say I can give you the best representation of it. I think that most Russians know that he's a thug. He's an old school KGB thug.
Mm-hmm.
He's very smart, without a doubt. Very, very intelligent dude. And supposedly one of the richest men, if not the richest, because if all his finances were actually visible,
yep,
supposedly the richest person or one of the richest people in the world.
In the world, yeah.
Yeah. But
which like, who cares? Once you have a certain amount of money,
right, it doesn't really matter. Yeah. And you're the leader of this, what you're trying to make, a new empire. And a lot of people see it as a strength. A lot of people see him as a scumbag and a thug, but they still see it as somebody who's finally at least stabilizing the economy there.
Mm.
And again, it's a mix of good and bad. On the one hand, you still have all this corruption and he's like murdering people in a political sphere. On the other hand, there's these dissimilarities that make for really fundamental differences. You now have Russians, politicians and powerful people whose children live here. So there's this fundamental difference between the Cold War and now, where there's a bigger risk for them and a more vested interest in still maintaining this order.
So you say the economy is good there. He's no,
I'd say all relatively speaking.
Right.
There's still a lot of corruption. There's still, again, there's oligarchs that own the majority of the wealth there. There's a large disparity as well.
Mm-hmm.
But there's more private ownership. There's more investment from the outside, and it's a long way to go, but there's still sparks of what eventually creates a free economy where people are able to move up the ladder and things like that.
Is he kind of considered a hero for what he did?
No, I don't think he's considered a hero. Okay. I think he's just considered a thug who's the same way that like old school in Brooklyn, you had different mob bosses who like protected stuff, and there was a value to that protection in the context that they were living in.
Right.
You know?
And the way you described him was exactly how people feel about Trump. He's strong. He's not necessarily,
Putin's a lot smarter than Trump, I think. Though.
Right,
but,
right,
yeah.
Right. But he's not like on the level. He's a little sketchy, but he's stabilized the economy. You know, people are like, well, he's good for the economy. I mean, that's turning out not to be the case.
That's one of the things that people say. But yeah, I see the similarities, but there's just these fundamental differences, I guess, of
sanity.
I don't think Putin's insane is the thing, for starters. Like,
right.
I think he's just less erratic as a
way
person.
More calculated, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, incomparably so.
Right. Yeah, and that's a big difference.
Yeah.
Do your parents like you being a comedian? Are they like, we came here, we worked so hard, and now you're just going to be make jokes?
I think they were worried during certain times, but I think the fact that I've never like come back and been like, I'm broke, I need to move back in or anything like that.
Right.
The fact that I've been able to like take care of myself, I've worked day jobs. Most, you know, I worked for one company. I did ad sales the first 4.5 years I moved to New York.
Mm-hmm.
Hated it. Eventually, I got fired / left. It was a
mutual
situation where I was trying to get fired, but then I was trying to get fired.
A conscious uncoupling?
A conscious uncoupling. That's a great, great way of wording it. I put stones in my vagina publicly. No, but they've been worried at times, but now they're pretty chill with it. And, you know, my brother also, he runs a marijuana paraphernalia company.
Oh, in Jersey.
In Jersey.
It's not legal. Wait, it just became legal there.
Well, paraphernalia. So when I just said marijuana paraphernalia, that's my opinion.
Right.
It's actually for tobacco use only.
Of course it is.
Officially.
Yes.
Dankstop.com, by the way.
For that, dank
I'll,
tobacco.
I'll get you a discount code.
But wait, it just became legal in Jersey. 2019, right? Marijuana.
Did it yet? I know he was planning on signing it. I don't know if it did already.
Okay, I may be jumping the gun on the date there.
Yeah, I'm not sure. You might be right, but I'm not sure if it's officially like all done,
right,
all said and done. But, I mean, if it does, that'll be great for him, or who knows? Or Amazon will go into the business,
sure,
and screw him and everybody else in the industry out and say, yep, we're the main distributor now. It's a crazy industry, but my point was that, like, I was like, not a troublemaker, maybe a little bit of a troublemaker, but more of like a jackass when I was a little kid. Mm-hmm. My brother was a troublemaker. Like he got into fights, he got arrested, like stuff like that. Whereas I was like more of like an idiot. I got suspended for like pulling dumb pranks and like,
right,
stupid shit.
Class clown kind of thing.
Yeah, class clown kind of thing. And my brother, like my mom once found him growing a weed plant in his closet and, mm-hmm, was like, and found a bong. I remember her shattering a bong. I remember her throwing this weed plant out. And in Russia, they didn't really have it. You know, they probably had shit weed if they did have it at all. To them, culturally, they were like, now they've come around a little bit. But, you know, in the beginning, up until we were adults, basically, they were very like old school propaganda, like marijuana is a drug. It's the gateway. It'll ruin your life, like, right, that kind of stuff. They were not into it at all. And my brother and I both been smoking since, I've been smoking probably since I was like 15, 16. Him, I don't even know. He might have started younger than I did. I know he started doing everything younger than I did, I'm sure.
Yeah.
He was just a cooler kid, but also like just more of a badass when he was younger.
Well, he was also in the States from a younger age.
Exactly. He was more in the States. He was assimilated. He didn't.
He's kind of a little more cool than you, I guess, right?
He's probably more than a little more cool than me. But he also probably doesn't have some of the damage that comes from like not knowing the language, going to ESL and getting made fun of for like weird cultural things.
Yeah.
So yeah, and also he like played hockey as a kid and like all that kind of, I never played sports as a kid really. I did music and theater and that kind of stuff eventually.
Mm-hmm.
But mostly just we terrorized our parents, and literally like I was trouble for teachers. And then my brother got to school, he looks a lot like me, or a decent amount like me, to where some of them would be like, oh no, you're Boris's brother, aren't you? Like they knew something was coming,
right,
and it was way worse than they expected, because he was worse than me on a fun. He like, I remember once he like shoved a teacher because the teacher tried to take his phone away, and he's like, he put his hands on my property. Like,
it's
like that kind of deal.
Yeah.
So, which, you know, you can respect that a little bit, mm-hmm, but I never did anything like that. I was just like, was an idiot. And so, I think now that my brother runs a company with like 40 employees.
Wow, 40, that's,
yeah, they grew. And he started in my parents' basement, him and his buddy, like posting photos of bongs on Instagram with, mm-hmm, a link of where to buy them, and just slowly grew it for 6 years now, I think.
Nice.
And grew it into like a legitimate company. So now that my brother's doing great, I'm doing like pretty good for a comedian. I think I'm doing decently financially, but otherwise not as well as my brother, that's for damn sure.
Right.
Or as well as most non-comedians.
That's such a yardstick for parents, like as long as you're supporting yourself,
yeah,
you're good.
And I mean, that's a big one, you know, you want to make sure that you raise the grown adult, you know. And then
but they have no objection to how he makes his money?
No, not at all. At this point, definitely not. He runs a distribution company as far as they're concerned. And also he does. He expanded it. He's got a wholesale brand. Mm-hmm. The warehouse he got has extra capacity. So he started a distribution company that just does regular distribution outside of that. Like, and he's like...
What's the name of the company?
The distribution company? I don't know.
No,
his company, Dankstop, Dankstop.com.
Dankstop.com.
Yeah. And I had him sponsor a comedy tour that I went on. Nice. So that came in pretty handy.
Perfect.
And I give out bongs at shows sometimes and stuff, you know.
Can you enter code Boris for 10% off?
I can make that happen. Let's say code Boris now and I'll have him added in.
All right. Nice.
Yeah, he'll definitely do 10% off for code Boris. So we can say that. What was my point? Oh, yes. Yeah, so just like, and now my parents have seen me do stand up a couple times and they're like proud. My dad's a funny guy. I got my sense of humor from my parents.
Uh-huh.
They grew up watching a lot of Russian comedians and they enjoy comedy, my dad in particular. And so now they didn't see me for a long time. I don't know if I felt weird about it or what, but it was only, I think maybe 2 years ago, my parents saw me do comedy for the first time.
Was that their choice or yours?
No, they were asking to see me several times. And then finally I had a show in Union, New Jersey, mm-hmm. and I invited them and it was a packed out show and I had a great set and they brought their friends and had a great time. And so, and now my parents saw me there. Then I did this one show that the only reason I invited them was because it was literally like blocks, like a 5 minute drive from their house.
Right.
And I didn't know what to expect. And because it was like a couple local, like New Jersey comedians. And actually, there were a bunch of really funny people there. It wasn't super well attended. So if that was their first time seeing me, I would have been a little bit embarrassed. But yeah. but they were at the show and I still had a great set despite the fact that it wasn't. They've never seen me bomb, which luckily doesn't happen regularly, that's for sure. But like, also, like, you don't want to bomb in front of your parents. That's
not. But even a poorly attended show, they'd be like, what are you doing with your life?
Exactly. So like, but they, I kind of warned them. I was like, I don't know what the expectation is here, but they enjoyed the show and there were other people that were really funny on it. And so they had a good time. And then I have my monthly show now, The Breakdown, and they went to see the last one.
Cool.
And I had R.L. Stein on it, who wrote Goosebumps, who they remember me reading as a child. So they were excited. My dad got a photo with me and R.L. Stein and my co-host, and it was a fun show. It was packed out. And and so now my dad will get excited, and he'll be like, you know, we're proud of you. You're funny. You're a good comedian. We like what you're doing.
He said that to you?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's what every
Now he says it all the time. He might be a little drunk when he says it, but nonetheless...
Right. Big drinkers?
No, I wouldn't say huge drinkers, but my dad lost his job not too long ago. So when he's not employed,
making maybe a connection.
The drinking picks up a little bit when he's not as employed.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
But otherwise, it's also Russian. So when there's a dinner, people are definitely down in shots and stuff. But it's the kind of thing where like these like... My dad's thankfully losing some weight now. He got pretty fat at one point, and he's going to have to deal with me talking publicly about that. I'm pretty mean to him, honestly. Like, sometimes my girlfriend even calls me out on it, where, like, I'm just like, no holds barred. Like, you look fat. You need to go to the gym. This is fucked up. Like, my mom is a cancer survivor, and she had a hormone receptive type of cancer where if you... It's very fortunate. It's a type of breast cancer that if you catch it early, it's very high survival rates.
Right.
And if you control the hormones, it also helps a lot with it. But exercising helps a lot. So ever since then, my mom's got a treadmill downstairs. My mom exercises regularly. She tries to get my dad to the gym. So I'll be very rough with him, sort of partly just because I'm a little bit of a shit, but also because I care about my dad and I don't want him in terrible health. But also because I care about my mom and I don't want her dealing with my dad in terrible health.
Sure.
They'll go on vacation and they'll go for walks and he has to like... You know, he gets tired before she does, and that's bullshit. I wouldn't want him hold me down.
You're being a good son.
I'm being a good son when I'm being an asshole to him.
Yeah. Who would win in a roast battle? You
me and
your
my dad.
Dad.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a better joke writer.
You are, huh?
You know, because I write jokes. I'm pretty good with roast jokes.
Right.
I've won my share of roast battles.
Yeah, you've done a few.
I've done a decent amount now. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a good one that I actually lost, but one of my favorites against Jess Fleischer on Roastmasters online. Mm-hmm. But we both came at it. She won, but I was so super happy they posted it because like we both had fucking killer roast jokes. I had such a blast doing it. Mm-hmm. But I've done a bunch of those now. I've done the new I'm blanking on what the new one is called. But I've done those. But yeah, I like doing roast battles. It's just great joke writing exercise. And, you know, I love the culture of it.
Yeah, you gotta have thick skin because they could dig
deep. You gotta have thick skin, but you know what? Like, people talk about safe spaces in New York, and that is the safest space. There's people doing trans jokes, there's people doing race jokes, and like everybody is just like together on it, you know?
It's
like
anything goes.
Anything goes, and it's agreed upon, and it just feels good. And there's a really great comic, Margot Reese, who's a trans woman, and she posted a whole thing about how this dude was like being an asshole to her on the train, and like calling her all this shit, and she was like, you know what, I felt all I could think of was like, this guy's a hack after doing a bunch of roast battles, because you know, she's taken like all these, you know, cruel but loving but with love jokes, because that's kind of the whole culture of it. So I like that shit a lot.
Have you done stand-up in Russian to a Russian audience or in Russia?
I wonder if I could do it. I used to freestyle rap a lot. I was part of an improv group that freestyle. And I've tried doing it in Russian, and my Russian's not amazing. I took Russian for Russian speakers in college, which brushed it up a little bit, and then, you know, some years passed and it's not as good. I borrow books from my grandma, and I never read them as much as I should, but I have like
books in Russian?
In Russian. Mm-hmm. I bet I could write jokes in Russian, and you know what? I'm sure I could just write jokes in English and translate them to Russian.
Sure.
Sometimes there's just a disconnect of sense of humor, where it's different sense of humor.
Culturally?
Yeah. But there's some Russian jokes that are like, I don't know if they're Russian or old Jewish jokes, but I definitely heard them in Russian.
Like what? Can you give an example?
Yeah, yeah. Actually, well, I have one of my favorites that's like, it's a
this is a Russian joke?
This is a Russian
from
joke.
From the Ukraine?
Yeah, this is, I remember hearing this as a kid. It's, this elephant is walking through the woods, and he sees a piece of shit on the trail. And he looks, and he's like, oh man, that looks like a piece of shit. Kind of gets close to it, sniffs it. Yeah, that smells like a piece of shit. Puts some in his hand, kind of feels it. Yeah, that feels a lot like a piece of shit. Tastes a little bit. Tastes like a piece of shit. Yeah, no, that's definitely shit. Puts it back down, walks around. Good thing I didn't step in it.
Nice.
It's a nice, like, nice little Russian. And there were, you know what's funny is I remember hearing old Woody Allen bits that he just took from like old Russian Jewish jokes, because where he's from. Mm-hmm. And I remember he had a joke that was like, you know what's funny is my dad told me this joke. And then I saw Woody Allen, and then I go to my dad, did you take this joke from Woody Allen? He's like, no, Woody Allen took this joke from old ass Russian jokes.
Right.
Where it's like, you like this watch? It's a nice watch. On his deathbed, my father sold me this watch.
Right. Yeah.
That was like, I forget if it was in like, what was the one where he does like stand-up bits in the beginning of it? I forget. But anyway, I think a bunch of his humor came from like Borscht Belt shit that they took from like old Russian Jewish.
Yeah,
stuff.
I mean, does he have a Russian background, Woody Allen?
Probably.
Yeah, he was writing jokes.
He seems like one of those Jews.
I mean, he was writing jokes as a like 12, 13-year-old.
Yeah.
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 So you consider yourself more of a joke writer or performer?
I think I'm a writer. But I've done it for many, many years to where I feel good as a performer. Mm-hmm. But I definitely started out stronger as a writer than a performer.
And I read on your bio you were doing warm-up for The Opposition on Comedy Central.
I did warm-up for The Opposition. They were looking for someone new. I did it once, enough to write it on my website. Don't you take that away from me, Gary.
Nope.
And then they got canceled.
It's a credit. The Opposition got canceled.
Yeah, before they found somebody new. They were still trying people out, so it's not like I was going to get it if they didn't get canceled. Mm-hmm. But I did it once, and they were trying a couple more people out, and then it got canceled.
Now, doing warm-up for a show, this is a common thing I mean, some people might not know about.
There's a whole circuit. There's a whole agencies world. For it. It is a whole world.
Now, how is it different doing warm-up comedy than doing like just a regular stand-up set?
Well, I'll tell you this much. I can tell you how it's different, but that won't necessarily describe what I did. I kind of met somewhere in the middle. If people have gone, it's a lot of like canned jokes that are like, you know, if you hear something funny, make sure you laugh, applaud wildly. If you hear something that you don't like, laugh, applaud wildly, you know, that kind of shit. And sometimes some warm-ups will just play music and dance. It's just about getting everybody like excited, making sure they're paying attention.
So you're a hype man, basically.
Yeah, you're a hype man, basically, which is not really what I did. I did some of that. I did a little crowd work, and then I did material because I was like, fuck it, I'm going to be funny and I'm going to make sure everybody's laughing and stuff, which I don't know, maybe I wouldn't have gotten it because of that, but I felt good about it. People enjoyed themselves. I had a buddy that worked there that got it for me that was like, oh, that was much funnier than another guy that did it.
Do you think maybe they don't want you to be that funny?
Honestly, I mean, it's sounds very narcissistic to say it, but completely separated from whether I was funny or not. Mm-hmm. It's very possible that they don't want you doing a ton of set of punchline jokes because right. it sets up a particular rhythm and energy that might not match the rhythm and energy of the show.
Right.
So that could be a thing where you don't want to do that too much. Yeah. I don't know necessarily that I did that too much, but yeah, I could see them not wanting somebody to just do a straight stand-up set before.
Yeah, I wonder, because you could do a set that you've been writing for years and they got to do new stuff every night.
Exactly. That's also true. And the inverse is true too. You know, I remember when this is a funny story. So really early in like a year and a half into doing stand-up, I got passed at Comics. Mm-hmm. Do you remember Comics? They were on 14th Street.
I wasn't here then, but yeah.
Oh, they were on 14th Street. They were a huge, beautiful club. Too nice. Clearly not sustainable.
Yeah.
Giant club. Really, really nice. The guys who owned it like co-owned a bunch of other businesses, so they didn't particularly care. Like, it wasn't like that they were that passionate about comedy. But the way that happened was I was also doing... I played music all through high school and I was making beats when I first came. Mm-hmm. I still do music for fun, but like I was really like at the time like making beats, and I started doing guitar comedy, musical comedy.
Uh-huh.
And then maybe 8-9 years ago, I gave that up because it felt corny and I just didn't like doing it. But I was still making beats and I was rapping and I was in a freestyle rapping improv group. North Coast, they still perform. They're fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would be doing beats and I met Tom McCaffrey, who's mm-hmm. a great stand-up.
I know Tom, yeah.
So I met him, I think, at the Creek in the Cave. Him and Jason Sines were doing a hip-hop act. And I was doing some stuff, and I probably hit him up, or we talked about it, doing a song together. I ended up doing a beat for something he was doing. We ended up doing a song together. Then he's like, I'm doing this song with Hannibal Buress, Rob Cantrell, Ted Alexandro, Dan Burr, and fuck, I got almost everybody and I'm blanking. I know I'm missing one.
Bunch of well-known comics.
Bunch of very good, well-known mm-hmm. comics. Hannibal was like just blowing up at the time.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, can you do this beat for me? It's a song called I'm a Headliner, and it's like rapping about I'm a Headliner. And so I do this beat, and then he's like, can you help me write a chorus? So I write the chorus, and he's like, do you want to sing the chorus? You might as well just sing it. You wrote it. So then I sing the chorus, and then he's like, hey, we're shooting a video. You sang the chorus. You might as well do this video.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm in this video with these headliners, and I'm the one in the chorus singing, I'm a headliner. Right. I got mad vagina from New York to China. Ain't no one finer. And so like it was auto-tune. I didn't sound that shitty, but...
oh, no, I'll auto-tune that. Well,
and that was... Oh, thank you. Auto-tune it in post, please. Can you auto-tune this whole thing?
Hopefully, yep.
So I do this song. They put out a video. And so thanks to that, I start doing shows with... I've been friends with Rob ever since. We've mm-hmm. been on the road together. We've done tons of shows. But I'm doing shows at Comics because they wanted us to do the songs. And then I'd start doing stand-up spots. And now I'm connecting this to what started this whole story,
mm-hmm.
was that I would be a year and a half into comedy, and like Todd Barry would come out and do his thing for 10 minutes, and I'd have to follow him with my tight five, like a year and a half into comedy.
Impossible.
And it was just like, yeah, I mean, it was okay. Sometimes it was not, and sometimes mm-hmm. it was fine.
Yeah.
But it was that energy difference where like a fucking master of his craft riffing for 10 minutes, you could have a really great 5 minutes even, but just energy wise, it's pretty difficult. It's different. People don't realize how much the energy of a room and how much a warm-up or a host is responsible, and really a good one
mm-hmm.
in a great show. People don't realize how much that person facilitates that great
Absolutely.
Show.
And were you doing the musical comedy then?
At that time, that was around when I just was starting stand-up. So yeah. I was like, so the thing for me was I didn't have such a cold plunge into the water with it. I was already on stage doing these like little funny songs and raps.
But you didn't consider that stand-up?
No, but the way I started it was kind of two things that were responsible to this day. I don't talk to him as much anymore, but there's this comic in Jersey, Doug, damn it, I'm blanking on his name. He's like a cop during the day, and I still see his like right wing cop memes on Facebook sometimes, but he's like in Jersey, and he would host this show, and I would do these songs, and I would do I would start to write jokes, and I would do like a couple minutes in between or something.
Right.
And he was like, you should think about just leaving the guitar at home, like try the jokes. He was one of the people that told me to do that. And then...
Why, because he thought you were a crappy guitar player, or?
I don't know. I'd like to think he was doing it as a positive. No, I'm still, right. I'm a pretty good guitar player, but I'm not a great singer. Uh-huh. And that's what ultimately was part of the decision. You know, I watched guys like Stephen Lynch and like Tim Minchin, and Minchin's a great musician, but Stephen Lynch really like has a beautiful voice. Yeah. And I'm not as much, probably if I listen to his songs now, I probably wouldn't be as much in them anymore either. But as a 19-year-old when I was like doing this stuff,
Bo Burnham
didn't exist yet, I don't think.
No, not yet.
But
probably wasn't even born.
That piece of shit. He'll do better than us all, or he is doing. What am I talking about? He is doing better than us all. But
probably will.
Yeah, and we'll continue to. But you know, when you have a great voice, it's also a lot funnier.
Right.
You know, like any really good musical comedian, it's like much better when they're good at music because it's just plausible. It's like, it's believable, you know? So it's the same way as delivering a joke well. To deliver a comedy song well, part of what makes it good is the fact that people see you as a serious musician, and then it's a serious, you know, somebody who's really a great musician can sing something that's bare. There's bands, I'm trying to think, like...
Like Reggie Watts has a great voice.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and well, he's just a whole unique thing in general, but like Bloodhound Gang, I think of, where they're like sort of kind of funny.
Uh-huh, right.
But they're fun, and they don't have to be that funny because they were musicians first.
Yeah.
Or a band first, or whatever they are, but like it makes it funnier when you take them seriously as a musician when they do this thing. And so I was never a great singer. I can kind of pull off some things, and like I still got better, and where like I was in bands and I would sometimes sing and things like that, but I was never that good where I could, it was just sell a comedy song properly.
So how long do you consider yourself have been doing stand-up comedy?
Probably like close to 9 years now.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, and but
there's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Let me tell you exactly. So 2007, I moved here. 2008. You know, it might be 10 years, actually. It might be 10 years. Mm-hmm. Because
it's kind of blurry. Like you kind of slowly morph.
It's a little blurry, but I know when that transformation really happened was... First year I moved here, I lived in Park Slope. And the second year I moved here, I lived in Hell's Kitchen. And during that time that I lived in Hell's Kitchen, there was this show at Stand Up New York called Music is a Joke. Mm-hmm. And they would do a season of it. And they had judges. And it was every Monday night, you submitted and they picked like 8 or 10 musical comedians. It was 8, actually, I believe, because it was 8 musical comedians that they picked. And every week, you have to do 10 minutes of new material based on a subject they give
you. Good challenge.
Great challenge. And when I say that, it's also a combination of like, if you happen to have a song that kind of fits this challenge, you can do it.
Yeah.
But it's still 10 new minutes for 8 weeks. So that's 80 minutes of different material you have to do for those 8 weeks. And A, that's a lot to write music-wise.
Yeah.
And it's nice to get a little break and throw some jokes in there. Mm-hmm. So I would start throwing more and more jokes in there. I did a lot of music writing during that point too, but I would start throwing more and more jokes in there. And that was where I also met Sabrina Jalise, who was a judge at the show. Mm-hmm. And I lived nearby, and we would, her and like a bunch of other people, we would all hang out and go back to my place and like smoke weed and hang out. And she's a fantastic comic, and she already was back then. She was like a superstar in Canada that just moved here. Mm-hmm. And so she was an influence on me because I'd watch her, and she was so good. And I started doing more jokes. And specifically during that time at Stand Up New York was when I was like sort of got sick of musical comedy from being so immersed in it.
Yep.
And started writing more jokes and mm-hmm. doing more of that.
Which I'm asking this for personal reasons because I'm also a musician. Which gives you... gets your yayas out more, writing music or writing comedy or performing stand-up?
I think performing stand-up in the end. I love writing, and again, I feel like that's sort of where I began with my strengths, but yeah. Now I love having that, you know, skeleton of punchlines, but then writing the energy of it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know.
Because I find a lot of creative people, and I find this... because I'm a creative person. But yeah. Like, I find this, if I don't do something creative for a while, I start to get very angsty and unhappy.
Yeah.
So whether I pick up a guitar and start playing, or I start writing jokes, or go out and do an open mic, you know?
Yeah.
Anything to just like get the creative juices flowing. But I've been finding that music is almost like a different part of my brain.
Totally. Yeah. I've gotten more into... what's funny is I like can play the bass a little bit because I... play guitar. But I've had a bass for a while because I've used it to like record stuff, record bass lines, and then all of a sudden recently I just started jamming out on bass more. Part of it was because I was jamming with my buddy Johnny Conroy, who co-hosts my show, and he's a phenomenal guitarist. I consider myself like a pretty good guitarist. He's like really, really good. So if we're jamming, I'm either doing rhythm or bass. Sometimes he'll do rhythm and I'll lead, and it's not that he'll like prefers it or whatever, but
it's
like,
almost so different than comedy, because comedy is very heady. You know, it takes place like very intellectualized, where music, you're not in your head at all. You're just like in your body and you kind of disappear.
I'd like to say that the performing isn't as heady for me. At least I tried not to make
stand up.
Yeah. Well, at its best, I definitely is when I'm not in my head.
Right. Of course.
But yeah, music's a whole different thing. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, I guess it's just more naturally like less antagonistic. Even when it's great, comedy yeah. still has a little bit of like tension and release.
Yeah.
But music is there is technically a tension and release with music. You want there to be a buildup. You've got yeah. that like seventh chord that you hit yeah. before you release it.
That's what the blues is.
Yeah. But, and that's, you know, my favorite thing to jam on too, is just little 12 bar blues.
Uh-huh.
But now when I got a free hour at home, and especially when I was smoking weed before this month, but like I'll just put on like a drum track mm-hmm. in Logic, and I'll just jam out on a bass line to it, or just like look up like Jackson 5 bass lines and like stuff that just does really like fun, like nice bass lines.
Yeah,
and
groovy bass line.
And I could just jam out with the bass line like for like an hour or something, you know?
Mm-hmm. And an hour disappears like that.
Easily, yeah. Easily.
So what's next for you? What are you working on?
A lot of stuff. I don't want to say most of it too preemptively, but the main thing, I've got my show The Breakdown.
Mm-hmm.
I've been doing it every month, and it's been getting better and better. We're slowly building a following, and we've been getting great guests. This last one was the biggest one so far.
Was that at UCB?
No, that's at so we started at the Slipper Room, and then at the Red Room upstairs at KGB Bar is where it is now.
Oh, cool.
And
New York City?
Yeah, Lower East Side, still in the Lower East Side. I like doing it in the Lower East Side. And the last one we had, like I said, R.L. Stein, who's like a childhood, like I read his books growing up, and mm-hmm. he was such a gem doing the show too. He like wrote comedy bits and stuff. Like like most of it is usually just like an interview, and I think of interview questions, and it's fun because I do an interview and then I have three improvisers. It's been different, but now we've got a set three that are all really fantastic, and they do a quick improv set based on the interview.
Cool.
And so I had him, and I had Andrea Belke from Survivor. She was on three series of Survivor. So I have a producer that's super helpful in it, and like we're really like starting to build a thing. So I'm pretty stoked about that. Aside from that, I'm working on just the same thing every stand-up's working on, mm-hmm. you know, submitting for late night and things like that.
Yeah.
You know, as far as what's next for anybody listening, hopefully I'll be in wherever they're listening from, and they should check me out live.
Nice.
We'll
put your link in the show notes.
Yeah. And then I'm doing a lot of writing. Actually, no, this is one that is close enough to completion where we're almost done with the music too. Me and my buddy wrote a musical about the guy who invented vaping.
There is one guy that invented vaping.
Yeah, Herbert Gilbert.
Is he still alive?
I think, but basically we based it so loosely. We like shit on him the whole musical just because it's funny. Our tagline is to do for him the opposite of what Hamilton did for Alexander Hamilton.
Nice.
So we just have him involved with like a lot of crazy stuff that's not even remotely historically accurate.
Right, right.
But we got Jody Shelton doing music for it, who's like, he did the music for the President Show when they did a musical special.
Oh, cool.
He's done a bunch of like Comedy Central stuff. The music lead for Baby Wants Candy.
So you wrote the script, not the music.
We wrote the script and the lyrics, and Jody's working with us writing the music.
Cool. Putting your lyrics to the music.
Yeah, exactly. Nice. And so once that's done, we'll probably start like, you know, doing a read through and staging it and seeing how we're going to produce it. So there'll be that. And then I'm working on writing like a bunch of shit that's all
in the works.
We'll see what happens to it, if anything. You know,
in the entertainment world, it didn't happen until it already happened.
Exactly. So hard to speak too early on stuff and then feel like an asshole later.
Yes. Well, thanks so much for your time. This is great.
Thank you.